So without further ado, I'm very pleased to present Eric Olinger.
Of course, sometimes the only way to ask a question is to tell me why some alternative is far superior to what I have to say. And so the ground rules can at least be interpreted in the broader sense of asking questions. In a footnote to a recent article in the American Journal of Sociology, John Goldthorpe, a sociologist who I have been told has refused to give public lectures at the LSE, at least at some point in his career, says of the concept of exploitation that it is, and this is a quote, a word I would myself gladly see disappear from the sociological lexicon. He adds, by way of clarification, quote, its function in Marxist thought was to allow a fusion of normative and positive claims in a way that I would find unacceptable. And he concludes, if invoking exploitation is no more than a way of flagging the presence of structurally opposed class interests that lead to zero-sum conflicts, then its use is innocuous but scarcely necessary. Many people, certainly in American sociology, and I think this would hold in British sociology as well, many people would agree with this judgment. Talk of exploitation seems more like a heavy-handed piece of antiquated radical rhetoric than a conceptual tool for understanding the inner workings of contemporary societies. In being a spectator in the recent British election campaign, I don't believe I heard the word exploitation or any of its words of kindred spirit mentioned even once. In this lecture, I hope to show that this judgment is wrong. I will argue contra Goldthorpe that exploitation is not simply a way of flagging some generic zero-sum conflict of interest, but a way of identifying a special kind of zero-sum conflict. And further, I will argue that one of the virtues of the concept is precisely the way it brings normative considerations into the core of the explanatory project of social sciences. This concept, of course, has its strongest pedigree in the Marxist tradition of class analysis, but I also hope to show that its explanatory relevance is not restricted to the problem of class, nor does it presuppose an acceptance of the theoretical framework of Marxism. It's an historical fact, of course, that the concept of exploitation was introduced into the ordinary language of social theory at a time when the labor theory of value as a way of thinking about economic relations was also part of the lingua franca, was part of the way economists talked about economies. And Marx thus expressed the concept primarily in terms of the idiom of the labor theory of value. I don't believe, however, that the sociological relevance of the concept of exploitation hinges on the labor theory of value at all. That's simply one way of talking about it, and I want to theoretically disengage the concept from the problem of the labor theory of value. This doesn't prejudge any debates around the labor theory of value itself. I'm just interested in showing that we can have a sociologically relevant concept of exploitation that would be a shame to see banished to the dust heap of history without deriving it from the language of the labor theory of value. Now, I want to elaborate this concept in a series of steps, the initial step of which is one that may seem a bit surprising. I want to share with you a comic strip from the late 1940s, created by an American cartoonist, Al Capp, who subsequently became an absolutely right-wing Cold Warrior, but he did have a certain populist phase in his work. In the comic strip Little Abner, those of you who happen to have read the first chapter of my book, Class Counts, will have already encountered this story. It's the way I start that book. This is an episode from the comic strip Little Abner in the late 1940s. It features a character who was a very endearing feature of that comic strip, a character called the Shmoo, S-H-M-O-O, not to be pronounced Shmo, which has a different cultural implication for those of you in the inn and would know what that would refer to. The shmoo has the following history. This is what a shmoo is. It's a creature yay big. It looks kind of like a pear with whiskers. I will show you a picture of the shmoo shortly. In the episodes prior to the one I'll be sharing with you today, the etiology of the shmoo is explained. It apparently is a mutation from some pre-shmoo creature. My guess is something like a wild turkey, caused by the American Army's decision to dump radioactive waste in the mountains of the Ozarks, located in the state of Arkansas. And that provoked this mutation, which produced the shmoo. The story, by the way, takes place in the small town of, hamlet, maybe is the better term, the small hamlet of Dogpatch, where little Abner lives. Now, the shmoo has the following properties. They have one purpose in life, which is to make people happy, to satisfy our basic needs. They do this by transforming themselves into things which we need for basic sustenance. But they will not turn themselves into luxuries. And they can do this transformation by reading our thoughts. They appreciate what we need, not necessarily what we want, and satisfy them. So if you wake up in the morning and are a bit peckish for a bowl of oatmeal, the shmoo will oblige and become a bowl of oatmeal. But if you want, you know, some wild smoked salmon with watercress on the side, the shmoo will not oblige. Unless, of course, through the progression of human needs, that becomes a basic necessity at some point. The shmoo and the story of the shmoo is silent on complex matters of the historical invariability or variability in the cultural context of the creation of need. So the shmoo does all these things, and it is so benevolent towards humankind that it will reproduce itself prior to its metamorphosis into your sustenance, and thus, if you are lucky enough to have a shmoo, you will never run out of shmoos. The shmoo taps a really deep cultural theme in Western civilization. It is actually the embodiment of the Garden of Eden myth. It's part of our origins myth. After all, what was the Garden of Eden? Garden of Eden was a place where humankind, limited in numbers at the time, could dwell without work, without labor, without toil. And when God kicks Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, one of the primary punishments, there's a number of them, you know, death and suffering, but among other punishments, from then on, they must earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. What the shmoo symbolizes is living in a world where you do not need to earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. Bread is simply produced by shmoos. But shmoos do not produce luxuries. So it is not the case that in a world of shmoos, people might not want to also work, but they wouldn't work out of necessity. They would work out of choice. And at whatever level you peg necessity, that's the level at which the shmoo would provide for your means of existence. It satisfies all necessary labor, to use a bit of old Marxian language, and makes the performance of surplus labor entirely voluntary, something you do because you want the stuff that you would get from doing additional work. Well, that's the shmoo. Now, the story is this. There is a prominent East Coast capitalist whose initials are, according to Al Cap, P-U, who wants to build a new canning factory. And he is on a scouting trip with his chief executive officer to find a place to build this factory. And after extensive research, they decide to locate the factory in the town of Dogpatch. And the story unfolds. Let's see, let me...
And now, P.U., we're coming to a spot where folks are so ignorant they've never dreamed of asking for more than we're willing to pay.
And they'll never get rich on that.
Uh-huh. Here they haven't been spoiled by that silly fad of working a mere eight-hour day. These miserable rats are in such desperate condition, desperate need, that they'll work a good old-fashioned 16-hour day.
You're a bright boy. How did you find such a splendid spot to move our factory?
Statistics show that there's more undernourished people in Dogpatch than any place. Those are the kind I like to deal with. They're so grateful, bless them. These poor, ignorant wretches will be grateful for the chance to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for $7 a week. They've never heard of anything better, and we'll never tell them.
Oh, you're a bright lad. The board may well give you a $500,000 bonus again this year. Remember, 1947 dollars, I suppose that's $8-10 million bonus at this point. But maybe we can pay him even less. Question one of them.
How would you like to earn $7 a week?
Did you say $7 for just 1 week?
No, I said six.
That would have been a tremendous fortune, B.S.
What do you mean, B.S.?
Before schmooze.
Only 18 hours of hard labor a day? Only 7 days a week? And you'd pay us just $6 for just that?
That would have been a mighty juicy proposition, B.S. Meaning before schmooze.
And now you see our friend, the pear with whiskers.
But nobody what's got schmooze has to work anymore, and anybody can for free. Schmooze does everything.
Everything? Oh, I suppose they provide you with the necessities of life. Milk, butter, eggs, meat. Stop laughing, you fool.
Great Scott, P.U. Do you realize what the schmoo means? Nobody will have to work hard anymore.
But who'll do the long, dreary, backbreaking labor in our canning factories?
Nobody, and what's worse, nobody'll need our canned stuff anymore. The schmoo provides all types of food, fresh and
free. Free food for everybody, that's horrible.
The schmoo must go. It's either it or us. Thank heavens its sinister influence hasn't spread yet.
Blast you, Wormley. Why are you stopping?
Because I've quit. I snuck a brace of schmooze under my coat in Dogpatch. Now I've got a whole herd of them. I'll never have to take your guff anymore, P.U.
And as a little coda to the story, when they get back to New York...
I'll forget the schmoo menace by taking Choo-Choo to dinner. That poor showgirl has been unemployed so long, she'll even go out with me for a square meal. Oh, I'd love to go to dinner with you, honeypot. I'll get you a big steak and...
You can take that steak and slap your own fat face with it. There's good schmooze tonight.
Now, actually, in the historical context, this comment on gender dimensions of the problem of exploitation or provision of necessities is actually, in some ways, a more startling set of panels than the stuff dealing more with the class issue. Because whereas in the ordinary sort of political, cultural atmosphere of the 30s and 40s, the notion that workers depended upon labor and thus selling their labor to capitalists in order to survive, and that the schmoo might disrupt that relationship, that was part of the standard cultural thinking of the time. Everybody would have been more or less aware of that imagery. But the notion that gender domination also depended upon economic dependence was not part of the ordinary discourse of the time. This is 1947. It's really pre-second wave feminism, needless to say. Now, Andy Capp was hardly a budding feminist critic of male domination. I think this is an interesting example where he had a device, the schmoo, and he just played out the logic of it and thought this was funny. You know, it was just the kind of funny thing to say, rather than making a political statement. That this political statement about male domination is kind of in spite of him. It's because he's serious about his cartooning, if you will, and played out the joke in one additional arena. Well, that's the story of the schmoo, just so you know what happens. I don't want to leave you hanging. It is not the case that the schmoo takes over America. The P.U. and his henchmen go back to New York. They hire the mafia
to go to Dogpatch to exterminate the shmoo. And of course, the shmoo being so willing to please sort of line up to get mowed down by the mafia, they don't put up any resistance. Little Abner, however, secures two of them and hides them off in the mountains, and thus the shmoo story continues for a while with the mafia out to do them in and Little Abner protecting them. Well, I want to use this story as a way of explicating a concept of exploitation in sociological terms. The shmoo story illustrates a social relational context within which the possibility of exploitation is eliminated by virtue of the presence of the shmoo, and therefore is a kind of theoretical counterfactual which will help us understand what exactly is going on when we have a relationship that is indeed exploitative. So the next step is to do a little bit more theoretical reflection upon the story of the shmoo as we've looked at it. And to do this, I want to do the following exercise. Let's take this simple story. Now, this is the class model, if you will, underlying the story of Dogpatch is an extremely simple class structure. There's really only two classes. There's the rich capitalist and there's the propertyless Dogpatch residents. The manager of the capitalist firm who gets the bonus for discovering, or would have gotten it, I suppose, for discovering Dogpatch is, in the context of this story, simply the junior partner of the capitalist. He's not a kind of middle class position. So this is a simple two class model. So let's work with this two class model. We have rich and poor, capitalists and propertyless. They're not yet workers, right? They're propertyless people. They have no means of production. They have means of subsistence because they have the shmoo, but no means of production. We have capitalists, would-be capitalists who are rich, and proto-workers who are poor. And let's ask what their preferences are for the fate of the shmoo. Let's suppose that shmoo's actually arrived. What would be their preference ordering for what should happen to the shmoo? And to create this sort of stylized game as a way of highlighting and eventually building the concept of exploitation, let's give them four choices. Four things can happen. Everybody can get a shmoo. That's one possibility. Nobody gets them. Get rid of the shmoos. That's the second possibility. Only capitalists get shmoos. That's a third possibility. And only the poor, only workers get shmoos. That's the fourth. There are four possibilities. And let's look at the preference orderings for the fate of the shmoo of our two classes, the capitalist class and the working class. Now, first for capitalists. The first preference of capitalists is that only capitalists get shmoos. Capitalists are a little better off having shmoos. Many capitalists like oatmeal in the morning, and they won't have to spend their own capital for purposes of getting their breakfast if they have a shmoo. First preference, only capitalists. Second preference, destroy the shmoo. Third preference, everybody gets it. If you can't destroy them, well, capitalists would rather that they have them along with everybody else. Then the fourth preference, which is that only the poor, only workers get the shmoo. Let's look at the workers' preferences. Now, the preference ordering for workers is based on their evaluation of what's good for them. We are disallowing two kinds of motives in these rank orderings. Altruism, they can't ask themselves what's good for other people, just what's good for me. Or resentment. They can't say, let's punish somebody else by denying them a shmoo because we want to be nasty to them. They can only be nasty to other people if it's good for them materially. So we're taking a very narrow view of self-interest. Just what is good for my personal standard of living, my material interest in the narrowest of senses. So the first choice for workers is that everybody should get a shmoo. Now you might ask, I imagine many of you are, why should workers want capitalists to have shmoos? Why would they prefer everyone getting a shmoo to only workers getting shmoos? Well, the reason is this. Remember, the shmoo only provides you basic necessities. So if you're a worker and you want to take your vacation in the Bahamas, or you want a big screen television rather than a small tabletop television, televisions don't figure in the shmoo story, but I think in
21st century world, the shmoo would also turn itself into a small tabletop television for you, because that's kind of a necessity of communication. But if you wanted a big television, you'd have to work for it. And workers would rather work for capitalists who are richer than poorer. Those capitalists who have the shmoo will have more room to maneuver in their bargaining over wages with workers. Workers in general prefer to work for employers who have more rather than less capital, because with more capital, they are less vulnerable to fluctuations in the market. There's more room to maneuver in bargaining over wages. In general, workers' welfare is enhanced rather than diminished when their capitalists have, for some exogenous reason, more capital. Therefore, workers prefer capitalists to have schmooze as well as everyone else. Thus, their first preference is everybody gets a schmooze. Second preference, only workers. Third preference, only capitalists, because again, schmooless workers are better off with capitalists who have schmooze than with capitalists who don't. And the worst preference for workers is that nobody gets a schmoo. Now, this rank ordering of preferences with respect to the schmoo captures, I think, what is in the first instance sociologically relevant about the concept of exploitation. This reveals a very sharp form of conflicts of interest. Because capitalists, their preference ordering is not merely opposed to the interests of workers, they have an active interest in harms to workers in this pair of preference orderings. Capitalists would rather deny workers a resource and have it destroyed completely than let the workers get the resource. This is not a question of distributive conflict. It's not a question of capitalists having something they don't want redistributed to workers. They don't want workers to have it even if it isn't redistributed from them. And that's a particularly sharp form of conflict of interest. It's a conflict of interest in which one actor has an active interest in the ill fare of another, not just being indifferent to their welfare. It's an active interest in the ill fare of others. The working class preferences, on the other hand, reflect something really quite remarkable. If you were to interrogate some profound moral thinker or religious leader, if you were to ask Gandhi or Jesus, or to perhaps be a little more prosaic, John Rawls as a philosopher, not meaning to put him in some pantheon of sacred figures, but if you were to ask them on moral principles of a universal character, what would be the rank ordering for the fate of the shmoo? If we were to rank order it not on the basis of any self-interest, but on the basis of human flourishing, of human welfare, if you ask the Marchesin the same question, they would say, well, first everyone should get a shmoo. That's the best option. And if that's not possible, the poor should get it. If that's not possible, well, at least the rich should get it, because the poor will be a little better off if the rich have shmooze than if they don't. And the worst option is to destroy this boon from heaven. You therefore have a correspondence under the terms of this very stylized story, a simple two-class model, and so on. You have a correspondence between what are the selfish, particularistic interests of workers, what are their interests defined strictly in terms of the question, what's good for me, and what we might want to call universalistic principles of justice or morality. This is one interpretation I think you can give to the old Marxian idea that the working class was a universal class. When Marx said that, what was meant was that embodied in their circumstances, not in their moral fiber, but in their circumstances, were interests for humanity as a whole. So that workers pursuing their class interests would realize, if successful, the interests of humanity, not just their own interests. When Marx made such a claim that the working class was the universal class, he was not making a judgment that they had noble character. He was not saying that workers were more high-minded, more spirited in some moral sense than were capitalists. And indeed, Marx had a very close association with an extremely high-minded capitalist, Friedrich Engels. Marx was not did not hold the belief that by virtue of one's class position, one couldn't engage in altruistic or morally driven actions. What he was saying, however, was that only in certain class positions was there a correspondence between the class interest
and some more humanistic, universalistic interest. And that's reflected in this Schmoo rendition of the character of the interests of workers and capitalists. Now, this kind of antagonism of interests, I would argue, is at the core of what the concept of exploitation is trying to get at. One little aside, actually, this is a digression for the hardcore sociologists amongst you who are familiar with arcane debates in class theory. If you look very closely at the Schmoo story, it turns out that the person in the story that gives a Marxian account of the consequence of the Schmoo is the capitalist, whereas the person there's another person who gives a Weberian account of the consequences of the Schmoo. The capitalist here says, do you realize what the Schmoo means? Nobody will have to work hard anymore if they have a Schmoo. Whereas the residents of Dogpatch says, nobody what's got Schmooze has to work anymore. That is, the residents of Dogpatch sees the Schmoo as merely threatening the exchange relation between labor and capital. Workers won't have to sell their labor power. Whereas the capitalist realizes that the real threat of the Schmoo is the difficulty of extracting effort. Nobody will have to work hard anymore. Extracting labor performance from workers, not getting them to show up, but getting them to work hard. And that's the core of what the concept of exploitation is about. Now, let me now ratchet this discussion up one more level of systematic sort of conceptual abstraction by drawing from it what I would describe as the three defining criteria that we would use to identify a particular social relationship as involving the kind of exploitation that we're talking about in the Schmoo story. Exploitation, as I would define it, involves three principles. The first I would call the inverse interdependent welfare principle. This states the following. The welfare of exploiters causally depends upon the deprivations of the exploited. The welfare of the exploiter is at the expense of the exploited. That's the first criterion. Second criterion is what could be called the exclusion principle. The causal process that generates the inverse interdependent welfare of exploiter and exploited depends upon the exclusion of the exploited from access to and control over certain important economic resources. And the third principle is what could be called the appropriation principle. The mechanism through which exclusion enhances the welfare of exploiters at the expense of exploited, the mechanism that does that, is the appropriation of labor effort of the exploited. When all three of those conditions are met, when you have inverse interdependence of welfare, exclusion that is based on exclusion from access to resources that generates appropriation of labor effort, when all three of those occur, you have exploitation. When the first two occur but not the third, you have what could be called non-exploitative oppression. Now, in the Schmoo story, the capitalist realizes that what's really jeopardized by the presence of the Schmoo is the appropriation principle. That's what you lose. You can't, the ability to get workers to work hard anymore. That is the ability to appropriate labor effort. That's what's threatened by the presence of the Schmoo. Workers are still excluded from means of production. That is, the Schmoo story is not socialism. It's not workers owning the means of production. They don't own the canning factory. And there still is an inverse interdependent welfare of workers and capitalists. But what is jeopardized is the appropriation principle. The contrast between the situation of non-exploitative oppression and exploitation has real historical bite. And I think looking at the difference between situations where the first two conditions are met, but not the third, and comparing it to conditions in which all three are met helps to emphasize the salience of this third point and why that gives particular sociological power to the concept of exploitation. And let me draw this contrast, that is the contrast between an historical situation of non-exploitative oppression and one of full exploitation. Let me draw that contrast by comparing the fate of indigenous people in North America with Southern Africa in the face of European settlement. The way I would describe this difference is that in North America, the indigenous people were non-exploitatively oppressed, but they were not exploited in general, whereas in South Africa, the indigenous people were exploited. That is, the first two criteria hold in North America, but not the third, whereas in South Africa, all three hold. That is, when white settlers came to North America, it is certainly the case that there was an inverse interdependence of welfare. The welfare of the white settlers depended upon was causally linked to deprivations of the indigenous people. And the mechanism of that inverse interdependence centered around exclusion, exclusion from the crucial economic resource of the historical period, land. But in general, Native Americans were not exploited. In general, they were not brought back onto the land as slaves or wage laborers, were simply pushed off the land, ultimately pushed west. So in North America, the first two conditions were met, but not the third. What that meant was that there was a solution available to white settlers in North America to the inevitable resistance of the indigenous people to their exclusion. Exclusion, after all, from the land will generate conflict. One doesn't need fancy social theory to make that prediction. If you have people who have historic use of the land and then they're excluded by force from access to the land, they will resist. But white settlers in North America had a solution to that conflict available to them, namely extermination of indigenous people. We have in North America a folk saying from the mid-19th century, which apparently was first spoken by an Irish general in the U.S. cavalry, I am told, whose name I don't know, but someone informed me of this. The folk saying is, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." That's a classic 19th century slogan of American culture. Now, fundamentally, from a moral point of view, that is indistinguishable from Nazi views of Jews. It's a Holocaust view. It's an exterminationist, genocidal view of one people towards another. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. And of course, it's morally abhorrent, but it's not logically incoherent. That is, it makes sense in the context of the nature of the conflict. It makes, I don't mean sense in a, I don't think I need to say this, in a moral sense. It makes sense from the point of view of the crass material interests of white settlers. If white settlers approaching the North American continent could have snapped their fingers and had the continent unpeopled, life would have been easier. It would have been basically easier for white settlers. Now, you know, you can give special exceptions. The Pilgrim Fathers on that first Thanksgiving might have had a tough winter, but North America would have been colonized, it would have been settled, and it would have had less trouble than it had by virtue of it being a populated region of the world. And it is, after all, a complete historical accident that there were people in North America. It has to do with the existence of a land bridge 40,000 years ago, which is an accident of the particular ways in which climate intersected migration patterns. And the ice age of the time created this land bridge. It could have been the case that North America was unpopulated, and if it had been unpopulated, no exploitation or oppression of indigenous people would have occurred. So the only good Indian is a dead Indian makes economic sense as a slogan. It would be absurd to have a slogan of the form, "The only good worker is a dead worker," or "the only good slave is a dead slave." You might say the only good worker is an obedient worker, or to use a contemporary catchword, the only good worker is a responsible worker, the favorite word of the British elections. Well, that's not true. There are other favorite words, but responsibility, in the United States as well, responsibility is a big deal these days as to what our culture is striving to find, to instill in people. The only good worker is a responsible worker. The only good slave is a docile slave, but not dead, right? The fact that the only good Indian is a dead Indian reflects the fact that the first two principles are present, but not the third. In Southern Africa, in contrast, indigenous people were used as labor. They were excluded from the land, but then employed in the form of servile labor, sometimes in the explicit form of slavery, other times in the form of coercive tenancies, and then, of course, later in the mines. And thus, in Southern Africa, there was a constraint on the relations between dominant and subordinate groups, a constraint caused by the fact that in an exploitative relationship, the exploiter depends upon the exploited. Now, here is really one of the key issues, one of the key issues in the concept of exploitation. In the concept of exploitation, exploiters need the exploited. In non-exploitative oppression, the oppressor does not need the oppressed. In exploitation, the exploiter needs the exploited. And that relation of necessity, of need, makes the exploiter dependent upon the exploited. They are bound together in a social relationship that ties them together, which cannot be severed if the exploiter is to pursue the exploiter's own interest. That interdependency, the fact that exploiters need the exploited, is a source of power for the exploited. And that is a really decisive issue. Exploitation relations are relations of power, but not just of the dominant group controlling the subordinate group. It's not power understood as one-directional, unconstrained domination. It's power as a relationship in which the relation of exploitation empowers the subordinate group as well. And indeed, this is one of the sort of deep structures of all class relations that have an exploitative character, namely that dominant groups are constantly figuring out ways to extract and elicit effort from subordinate classes, and they wouldn't have to do that if subordinate classes didn't have this crucial means of resistance, namely that people ultimately control their own level of effort and diligence. People are not machines, we're not robots. Our capacity to control our level of effort is a severe constraint on the nature of exploitation relations and gives exploited groups a capacity for on-the-ground bargaining that non-exploitatively oppressed group simply lacks. This contrast between exploitation and non-exploitative oppression, I think, has relevance to certain circumstances today. One way of understanding the predicament of the underclass in the contemporary highly developed capitalist economies is to understand the underclass as a category of people who are excluded from access to what turns out to be a really crucial economic resource, namely human capital, and as a result are not really exploited except marginally and episodically. They are non-exploitatively oppressed by virtue of being excluded from access to acquiring a particular economic resource, but they are not generally exploited, and thus their cooperation is not required. All that's required is their acquiescence, their passivity. Now, it's some measure of progress, I suppose, from the 19th century that the solution to the problem of the underclass is no longer legitimately simple genocide, the idea of simply going in and getting rid of them. But the solution in the United States isn't that far off. If you look at the number of people imprisoned in which purely repressive solutions to the problem of marginalization, where marginalization in this sense means exclusion from access to the crucial resource needed to be exploited, namely human capital. So I think the concept and this differentiation between oppression, non-exploitative oppression and oppression does apply to certain salient categories in class relations today, the underclass. Now, I said at the outset that I thought this concept of exploitation that I would be advancing, that is a concept based on these three criteria, that this concept doesn't apply only to class situations, that we can extend these ideas to deal with other forms of interdependent relational interaction, which can properly be described as forms of exploitation. And without going into extended detail, I think, for example, one could talk about sexual exploitation in these terms. And one might distinguish between sexual oppression, non-exploitative sexual oppression, and full-blown sexual exploitation using these same criteria. If you consider the difference, for example, in the treatment of homosexuality, the nature of the oppression of homosexuality in some societies, and the problem of the sexual exploitation of women, I think one can see this as following, in a rough way, these three criteria. So let's consider the interests, the sexual interests now, not the material interests, but the sexual interests, the interests in sexual gratification of homophobic heterosexual men. And let's, for purposes of argument with this simple illustration, let us imagine, let us see the extent to which, let's assume that homophobic heterosexual and heterosexist men are the dominant group within the social relations of gender and sexuality. And let's look at their sexual interests with respect to women, first of all. Well, one could argue that the sexual interests of heterosexist men, their sexual gratification occurs at the expense of the sexuality of women. It involves exclusion from their control over their own sexuality. Thus, for example, things like the double standard, that men can philander but women are punished for doing so. That's an example of exclusion from full control over sexuality. And there's an appropriation. The welfare of men depends upon their appropriating sexual effort from women. If women stop performing sexual effort, so to speak, if they simply disappear, the sexual interests of heterosexist men would be harmed. Now, in contrast that to their sexual interests with respect to homosexuality, where they don't appropriate the sexual effort of homosexual men in the stylized constructs that I'm giving. And therefore, if they could snap their finger and have homosexuality disappear, their sexual interests, as they understood them, would be enhanced, not diminished. Now, one can, I think, see that there's a different structure of interdependencies created by sexual exploitation from pure sexual oppression. And as in the class case, sexual exploitation is a source of empowerment for the sexually exploited, not just of their subordination. And indeed, as feminists and even more generally those sociologists who pay any attention to this have noted, the control over sexual effort by women is one source of leverage that they have within unequal relations of domination. It's a source of leverage. It is a source of power, albeit not one that's capable under many historic circumstances of overthrowing their subordination. But it is a source of power, which they would lack if the sexually oppressive or exploitative group did not itself depend upon their sexual effort. Well, that was just to illustrate that there is, I think, salience to these criteria and the kind of complex interdependencies of interests and conflict which they reflect that applies outside of the class arena. I think one can also talk, although this may be getting more distant from the strict logic of these three criteria, One could also talk about a distinction between cultural oppression and cultural exploitation in these terms. If you compare, for example, the relationship between the dominant European culture and indigenous cultures in the United States in the 19th century from the present, one might want to say that at the present, Native American culture is exploited by the commodified commercial dominant culture, whereas in the 19th century it was non-exploitatively oppressed. The practice, for example, in the 19th century of taking Native American children from their homes and rearing them in, excluding them from the means of cultural production, of which language is, of course, a central, if not, you know, it's not the only element, but it's certainly a central element. The effort to stamp out indigenous languages is an effort at exclusion. It involves exclusion. It creates cultural oppression. But there's no appropriation of the cultural products of the subordinated group. Whereas if you look at the cultural relations between dominant and subordinate cultures in the United States, indigenous cultures today, there's a massive appropriation of cultural product from Native Americans, ranging from New Age spiritual appropriations to the commercialization of Navajo jewelry and so on. Now, as in the case of class exploitation, it's basically better to be culturally exploited than culturally oppressed. It's better to be exploited if you're in a class relation than to be non-exploitatively oppressed. It's better to be in a situation where the only good worker is a responsible worker than in a situation where the only good Indian is a dead Indian. It's better to be exploited than non-exploited if you live in a set of social relations in which those are the options. And it's better to be culturally exploited than culturally oppressed. Now, that doesn't mean that it isn't better still to be culturally autonomous. But cultural exploitation does provide a shield and a lever for the culturally exploited. So again, that's another extension of this notion of exploitation based on these three criteria outside of the immediate narrow confines of class theory. Now, this way of understanding exploitation did not at any point invoke any of the technical apparatus of the classical Marxian tradition. There was no discussion, for example, of the value of commodities and the relationship of the performance of labor time to the exchange value of the things produced by labor. And indeed, I believe that it is unnecessary to make any statement whatsoever about the relationship of the performance of labor and the value of commodities in order to establish that all three of these criteria are present in capitalist class relations. Capitalists have antagonistic interests with respect to workers over the appropriation of labor effort, whether or not it is the case that the value of commodities is directly proportional to the abstract labor embodied in those commodities. Now, it may also be true that the exchange value of commodities is proportionate. That's a separate matter. I myself am relatively skeptical about the robustness of the labor theory of value as a way of thinking about the value of the products of capitalist economies. But that is not relevant to the specification of the social relational structure of interdependencies within which this kind of complex antagonism of interest is created. I'm going to drop one section of this so that we'll have more time for discussion, which is a more systematic comparison of this way of thinking about class and exploitation and the standard Weberian language of class. For those of you who are interested in that little bit, it is in this first chapter of my book, In Class Counts, where I discuss what I've sometimes called the Weberian temptation. You know, Weberian class theory is a lot easier than Marxist theory, precisely because it doesn't bother with complicated concepts like this. But I'm going to bracket I'm going to bracket that. Let me just conclude by making a number of points as to why I think grounding a concept of class. So now, returning to the central idea of exploitation as a way of thinking about class relations, why grounding an analysis of class and the concept of exploitation gives you an analytically, a sociologically powerful concept. What are the advantages of doing this? What are the payoffs? I won't go actually through my entire list either. Let me just mention two or three of these central points. First, I think understanding class relations as linked to the problem of exploitation gives one a deeper understanding of the problem of conflict within class relations than you get if you see class relations as only involving conflicts over distribution, only conflicts over income, or only conflicts over what Weberians call life chances. There's a deeper understanding of the character of the conflict when it is expressed in terms of the nature of the interdependencies that involve one set of actors having active interests in the ill-fare of another, which is captured by these three principles. Secondly, the exploitation-centered understanding of class relations brings into the analysis of class a more complicated understanding of power relations. There's a tendency, this is true in some Marxian discussions as well as others, there's a tendency in much sociological discussion to see power as simply one-directional, that power is always the power of A over B, end of story. Rather than seeing the power relations as involving reciprocal relations of resistance and control in which the extent of resistance possible is part of the relationship itself. What exploitation does is highlight the ways in which subordinate groups have power resources inherently in their relational position with respect to the dominant groups. And this is crucial for understanding the very complex counter-strategies exploiting classes are forced to adopt in order to contend with the forms of resistance that are built into the relation itself. Even things as simple as the creation of regimes of monitoring and supervision on the factory floor as kind of standard bit of the understanding of how capitalist organizations of production work is related to this fundamental feature of the relations between capital and labor embodying exploitation. Because that monitoring and control and sanctioning on the factory floor has to do with the fact that the performance of labor effort is always problematic within a class relation. And that's by virtue of the fact that the relation is not just an exchange relation, but a relation that embodies exploitation as well. Third, I think, and this is getting a little more high-blown, if you will, I think that the concept of exploitation helps us to build what could be called an endogenous theory of the formation of consent within a theory of class relations. Elaborating class analysis in terms of the contrast between exploitation and oppression, which is the exploitation and non-exploitative oppression, which is embodied in this way of thinking about exploitation, can contribute to a theory of the endogenous formation of consent. The argument is basically this. The extraction of labor effort in systems of exploitation is costly for exploiters. It's costly to extract labor effort because of the ability of people to resist. That was my previous point about power. Purely coercively backed systems of exploitation often turn out to be suboptimal, since in many circumstances it is just too easy for workers to withhold diligent performance of labor. It is suboptimal for capitalists to deal with the problem of exploitation in exclusively coercive ways. And this means that there is an inherent pressure inside of a relation of exploitation to push for non-coercive solutions to the problem of extracting labor effort. Exploiting classes, therefore, will have a tendency to seek ways of reducing the costs of extracting labor effort, and they do this by elaborating all sorts of institutions which end up constraining the exploiter as well. Now, this is a way of thinking about what in classical Marxism was called base and superstructure, but hopefully in a way that is not quite as homeostatic and functionalist as in the classical Marxian formulation. Let me just give you a couple of simple examples. These should not be surprising. The simplest example is a favorite one of some neoclassical economists, indeed. The payment of wages above market clearing wages, what economists call efficiency wages. The payment of wages above the market clearing wage, that is above what would be the equilibrium wage, strictly from a market point of view, that is something that one would predict if you see the class relation as an exploitative one. That employers will have an incentive to pay workers a wage above the market clearing wage because among other reasons, if you pay them above the market clearing wages, it will increase the sense of loyalty of workers to the firm, a sense of justice in the sort of fair day's wage for a fair day's work norm. And that above market clearing wage, therefore, makes it less costly for employers to monitor and extract labor effort from workers. Paying workers more can actually save employers money. Now, that's an idea which doesn't have to be derived just from a theory of exploitation, but it naturally flows from a sociological understanding of exploitation. Creating internal labor markets. John Goldthorpe's favorite kind of example for his understanding of class as what he calls a service relation. Creating internal labor markets is also a device that you would expect would create forms of consent within production that make the extraction of labor effort less costly for employers. Well, finally, just to round off this, it's taken me longer than I had said initially. As a final advantage to linking class analysis to a concept of exploitation, I would return to John Goldthorpe's reason for rejecting it, namely its fusion of normative and explanatory elements. The most fundamental payoff, I believe, for these kinds of conceptual foundations for class analysis is the way in which it does infuse class analysis with moral critique. The characterization of the mechanisms underlying class relations in terms of exploitation focuses attention on the moral implications of class analysis, not just its explanatory implications. Exploitation identifies ways in which these relations create harms, not merely inequalities. Exploitation highlights the way in which structures of interdependent relations create harms, not simply inequalities. Class analysis can thus function not simply as part of a scientific theory of interests and conflicts, but also of an emancipatory theory of alternatives and social justice. Even if socialism is off the historical agenda at this particular moment, the idea of countering the exploitative logic of capitalism is not. Well, I welcome any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Here's what I would suggest we do, because I know many of you have an important test in 2015, which this material I think I'll be using. But I'd like to invite a couple of comments. I wonder if any of this is something up your street. You, Angus, would like to start with.
Talking and therefore the possibility of a wide range of different interrelationships between various patterns of settlement and Native Americans simply are limiting initially by due to micro-political maneuvering in Washington, basically, to put it very simplistic and schematic terms. But I wonder if there would be a point at which making the distinction to which you wanted to attach considerable analytic weight might conceivably obscure more than it illuminated.
Well, this certainly obscures more than it illuminates about the complex variation in the settler indigenous population relations in the United States. That is, there's a lot of variation and it changes over time. And this was meant to be more of a stylized characterization, which does get embodied in this folk saying, which only makes sense in the context of non-exploitative oppression. That is, that saying wouldn't make sense otherwise. So that the saying gets instituted at the time when pushing Native Americans to the West is no longer an option. That is, the prior version of this is the only good Indian is the Indian that isn't here. You know, push them west, displace them. That's exhausted by the last quarter of the, probably last third of the 19th century. And that's when then sort of the final solution, since displacement isn't an option, gets into popular rhetoric. And again, I think, though, that still does illuminate the logic of these categories. But of course, if I was to propose a full class analysis of Native American civilization and how it was absorbed and repressed and integrated and marginalized, you know, all of these things going together, I would need to talk about how exploitation and oppression coexisted and interconnected. An interesting category in just ordinary sort of capitalist relations that bears perhaps on your comment is this notion of the reserve army of the reserve army of labor, the unemployed. The unemployed are not exploited, and they are economically oppressed, but they are exploitable. The difference between the reserve army of the unemployed and the underclass as concepts, which in Marx's rhetoric would be which had other political tones, would be the distinction between the reserve army of labor and the lumpen proletariat. But the distinction there is between labor which is marginalized from active production but which is available for exploitation and therefore acts as a pressure on workers who are exploited versus labor which is completely marginalized from the system of production, which is what the underclass concept would give you, and which I think is also captured by, you know, the non-exploitative oppression and exploitation contrast.
Can I just add something to that? If I understand the drift of Angus's question, it might be that what you're wondering is how does a system move from category 1 plus 2 to category 1 plus 2 plus 3? And it's an interesting historical problem. That is, if you've, as with the Indians, you've created non-exploitative oppression, you've created a situation historically in which you've lost a resource for future exploitation. And perhaps some of the historical modeling on this would be what feeds back to what? That is, if you've got 1 plus 2 plus 3, you can always revert to 1 plus 2. But if, as in the case of genocide, once you've destroyed the other, right, the system is closed historically. This the plus 3 cannot be added. So it might be, as in the case with slave systems, that you have to start with exploitation, and that the degradation of exploitation into non-exploitative oppression then is where a system will jam. It can never recover that.
Now, it is true in the indigenous population case in North America, there were attempts at enslaving Native Americans,
right.
Particularly in the southeast quadrant, but largely unsuccessful. It was too easy for the enslaved population to find the social supports to escape and to resist, whereas an uprooted subordinate population, namely the African diaspora, was much more controllable. So that that exploitation option was tried, I think, in a fairly limited way. I don't know the actual data on it.
It's a question about historical historical. I'm sorry, I cut you off, sir.
Yes, but another question in relation to the usefulness of your causal analysis and explanatory types. I'd like to put forward the way in which the Australian situation doesn't really fit your model. We have certain similarities, but I'll briefly indicate why it doesn't.
Briefly.
We have a very, very militant working class at the end of the 19th century, and compromise was initiated called the Deaconite Settlement, in which the White Australia policy was initiated. And this White Australia policy, as you well know, entails the forcible removal of Pacific Islanders from Australia, plus the exclusion of mainly Chinese and non-white working class people in Australia. The universal interests of the most militant are all in favor of the White Australian policy, thereby invalidating your position on exploitation. But interestingly enough, the majority of the capitalist class in the organization are also either in favor of excluding a source of labor that would in fact cheapen their cost of production and not simply be just a non-exploitative cultural form of practice. So we have that situation. Plus, we have the complication of the indigenous Aboriginal and Torres Strait population, who are, in your model, not exploited abundantly, and they are simply subjected to similar type of forms of genocide and other activities as the Native Americans. But one section of them do, in fact, become exploited and work for quasi-slave labor as on the large until later on in the century, in the 20th century, the union movement represents their universal interests and gets them award wages, which thereby sees their removal from these stations because the large corporate agribusiness no longer wish to employ them. So we have a situation of historical change of flow where, in your model, it wouldn't be able to account for the type of variations. And we're not talking about a little type of movement, but we're talking about a labor movement that was there before the Labor Party was organized in Australia, the first labor government in the world, and so forth.
Right. In fact, I think your characterization of the problem you characterized it in terms of these categories, in a way that was illuminating. For example, take the first point. Let's take the last point first about the Aboriginal populations that were incorporated as exploitable labor in certain regions or parts of Australia. And once they became organized, it was no longer the optimal strategy from the point of view of capital, and from their point of view then they were excluded once they became organized, but when they were unorganized, they were exploitable. Now, that to me describes a situation where once the balance of power between capital and labor in those regions were such that it became in the interest of capital, presumably, to employ more capital-intensive technologies, they displaced labor because it had become too powerful or too organized or too expensive.
But how would you explain the capitalist class wishing to exclude
There are lots of in a full social analysis of the strategies of capital and labor with respect to potential sources of labor, there's many issues besides this bald, simple, very abstract model of class relations. So questions of class compromise between capital and labor and the conditions under which that can be stably reproduced become important. For the Australian working class to want to exclude sources of labor competition is entirely consistent with this framework. It implies that their belief was that the conditions of their performance of labor and their bargaining position with capital would be improved when, in the absence of a massive surplus labor population or reserve army of labor. So it's understandable why workers would support that position given these criteria. The question is, why would capitalists support it? And there I think you have to think of what the opportunity costs, what the relevant range of feasible options are for capitalists as well. So they face the following options: a class compromise with their indigenous working class, which presumably was a relatively skilled working class, at least had skilled components to it. The lack of plausibility that working class could be replaced wholesale by cheaper labor. And therefore, what they're asking themselves is, what's the long-term or medium-term gains that we would have by lowering wages at the bottom end of the wage and skill spectrum by having competition from unskilled immigrant labor versus a class compromise with a well-organized indigenous working class? And in that context, it seems to me a class compromise from the point of view of capital could well be the optimal strategy. In terms of their understanding of the conditions under which they will most successfully be able to extract labor effort from their employees and balancing that off against the nature of the wage bargain that they would have to have.
Yes.
You're going to have to shout.
Sorry.
This one?
Yeah.
Shout.
Logical issues that may arise in this. I'm not really clear about whether this categorical scheme works in the sense that how these things relate to each other, the oppression and exploitation. If you look at what we said at the bottom, 1, 2, 3, it's non-input oppression.
Stop with this one.
Okay. The pivotal structural element comes in the second criterion, or at least the first component of the structural argument comes in the second component. That is, the exclusion principle is defining a relation by which one group, let's call it a group at the moment, is able to exclude others from access to particular resources.
But that would be a ward of that, in the case of zero-sum game.
Right. That's a perfectly general notion of exclusion. The question is, does that exclusion cash itself out in an ongoing form of interdependency, or is it a one-off?
Well, I can see that interdependency, but that'd be a part where you wouldn't want to store your own work. That's okay, but I'm just saying that as you go, if they want us to do that, it doesn't necessarily imply oppression.
Well, a war would be an example. No, but a pirate raid in 1944. take all the resources away, satisfies one and two. And it would be a form of non-exploitative oppression. That is, the Vikings oppressed the peasantry on the northeast coast of Britain.
Is your question that hierarchy is missing somewhere?
Yeah, I'm trying to work out why there were two warring groups.
Well,
even if they have a threaten to commit violence, and that's enough, then you've got a position where you have got an exclusion of view from what happens to get older than vice versa.
If one group excludes another from access to resources which the other group needs, and it does so through coercion rather than some kind of mutual consent, if there's a coercive element, then I think we can describe that as creating a set of antagonisms of their interests that I would then label as oppressive. Now, one could then say that there may be cases in which the oppression might indeed be justified on the basis of some other values.
But it could be particularly coincided if there's two warring societies fighting over a bit of land. Who's the oppressor?
Well, whoever, if they're fighting over a bit of land and they just divide it up, then there isn't. There's not. The asymmetry in the exclusion process isn't present in that case. They divide it up, and it's not that one's excluding the other.
Okay, we have one more formal question, because we're way over our normal time. You get the last word. Eric will be here informally, whoever can stay.
Yeah, I can stay for a while.
Yeah.
I just have a question about that.
Okay, but you
I don't get to the point. This sounds fine, but I think it's too static. In and of itself, I mean, where's the dynamism to exploitation? So the road of production concept seems to have that dynamism which is lacked. Do you need to connect that into that concept? In other words, what's the difference between capitalist exploitation, state socialist exploitation, feudal exploitation? Is there a dynamic? I don't think in a whole way he captures it on the way you presented it here.
Well, yes, all I've done here is provide a basis for a diagnosis, a kind of a Schmoo test of exploitation, if you will, a diagnosis for when a social relationship is exploitative. Now, the exclusion principle implies a set of social relations within which, to make this a little bit more elaborate, a set of rights and powers over resources are institutionalized in some way. The difference between what we call modes of production depends upon how exclusions are organized. So in some modes of production, for example, people are allowed to own other people. You're allowed to have rights and powers of control that are effective abilities to deploy the resource, in which the resource in question is other people. We call that, when the rights and powers in question are absolute, we call it slavery. Now, the argument about modes of production and dynamics, then, is that the particular distribution of rights and powers over resources, which is the guts of that exclusion principle, sets in motion different kinds of class relations, different kinds of class conflicts, and different kinds of problems for dominant or exploiting classes to solve. So different sorts of problems of consent and reproduction get set in motion by the nature of the exclusion principle. This has been raised at a high enough level of abstraction that it could apply across different kinds of class relations. That was the point, to provide a very general concept of exploitation. We can then diagnose feudal class relations, slavery, capitalist class relations, and other kinds of class relations, not conventionally in the Marxian menu, on the basis of the nature of the exclusion principles and how they work. And then the argument about dynamics is that those exclusion principles set the terms for the problem of extracting labor effort and the problem of reproducing the relationship. And thus you have different ideological and political problems to be solved with respect to different exclusion mechanisms.
A continuation. Let's thank Eric for a wonderful presentation.